From the Sky News Centre at 5, our unhealthy lifestyle is being blamed on a huge increase in the number of women getting breast cancer. 1 in 8 women in the UK are now diagnosed with the disease. Survival rates, though, have also improved, which is being put down to better diagnosis. Mike Hobday from Macmillan Cancer Support says a diagnosis has a massive impact on a woman's life.
The psychological effect, it is still a very shocking disease to be diagnosed with. The financial effect, issues like how and when a woman can return to work after successful breast cancer treatment.
Sustained gunfire has been heard close to Cairo's main square, where around 100,000 protesters have gathered for a day of departure rally. They want to see President Mubarak leave office, something world leaders have again stressed must happen soon. Three Pakistan cricketers are to be formally charged over alleged spot-fixing during a test match against England. Salman Butt, Mohammad Asif and Mohammad Amir are accused of conspiracy to cheat. Three RAF servicemen have been jailed for helping smuggle 7 million cigarettes into Britain. The contraband was brought in on military flights from the Middle East in 2008 and 2009. They were then sold on without paying import duty or VAT. Excitement is building ahead of one of the most eagerly awaited opening matches in the history of Rugby Union's Six Nations Championship. Wales face England in Cardiff's Millennium Stadium, and England manager Martin Johnson says it will be a fantastic spectacle.
I think playing under lights is really atmospheric, and it's a great stadium anyway. We've never denied that. It's a great place to go and play rugby in Wales. The passion they have for it's huge.
The row concerning Cesc Fabregas' alleged half-time comments in the midweek match against Everton has taken another twist. David Moyes says he heard words from the Arsenal captain, effectively accusing the Merseyside club of paying match officials. Arsenal manager Arsene Wenger claims there's a witch hunt against his skipper. That's the latest. I'm Jeremy Coulter.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
BCFM Travel News, in association with the Global Traffic Network, supported by the Highways Agency.
The M48 Old Severn Bridge is closed to high-sided vehicles and motorbikes because of the strong crosswinds in the Severn estuary. Also, as you go towards the bridge, you'll just divert onto the roundabout before going onto the bridge itself. Looking at the cameras, though, traffic on the bridge is coping well. Not the same, though, I'm afraid, on the westbound M4 going across into South Wales via the second Severn crossing. Long delays with lots of traffic heading towards Newport, towards Cardiff, I should say, for the rugby this evening. It's queuing from just around junction 18, the A46 turning for Bath, all the way through towards Newport and the Bringlass tunnels. It's taking a good 2 hours to get through those queues now. Also, the northbound M49, as you go towards the M4, is queuing through the lane closure. There's a lane closure just before the M4 roundabout for roadworks. And if you're going west on the A40 into South Wales, traffic through Herefordshire towards Monmouth is looking slow. It's slowing down around Whitchurch and then queuing towards the Monmouth traffic lights, taking about half an hour to get through those delays at the moment. The eastbound M4, beware of an accident between junctions 18 and 17. That's the A46 turning for Bath and the turning for Chippenham. Also in Wiltshire, the A303 going west towards Amesbury is queuing towards the Counties roundabout through the roadworks. And also, if you're using the A46 between the M4 and Bath, there are some temporary traffic lights near the Cold Ashton roundabout. That's the A420 junction, while a burst water main's being dealt with. That's causing queues in both directions, but particularly slow on the southbound approach going from the motorway towards Bath. I'm Chris Wood.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Hello Bristol and welcome to Friday Drive Time, BCFM's politics show. I'm Tony Gosling. I'm joined this week by Lib Dem councillor for Eastville, Steve Comer. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news this evening, a new initiative in the city to help skilled people, including the jobless, who have no prospect of a mortgage, to build or even part build their own homes. Bristol Community Land Trust has just signed up its first 150 members. Last week it was the BBC, but this week, in the second part of our series on censorship, we look at the Bristol Evening Post and question the motives of the editors Mike Norton and assistant editor Rob Stokes, specifically looking at the paper's coverage of Bristol millionaire, tax exile and Bristol City Football Club chairman Stephen Lansdowne's bid to build a new football stadium for his club on a greenfield site in Ashton Vale. And after Louis Theroux's TV documentary with Israeli settlers last night, Bristol academic Margaret Jones looks at the Jewish groups in the Middle East and around the world who are campaigning against racism and religious extremism. Instead, they want peace and equality with the Arabs. That's in the second hour after six. On to our review of this week's news in a minute, but first here's our two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 9 Celsius, some rain easing off as the night progresses, but windy. Highs of 12 this weekend, this 12 degrees Celsius, generally cloudy with gusty winds, wetter on Saturday, slightly contrary to what we were saying last week, I seem to remember. But anyway, next week, highs of 11 degrees Celsius, a fairly wet week with the gusty winds dying down as the week progresses. The driest and sunniest days look like Tuesday and Wednesday. Next weekend, that's the 12th and 13th of February, having a stab at that because it's quite a way in the future. Highs of 9 degrees Celsius next weekend, drier on Saturday, wetter and windier on Sunday. That's the 12th and 13th of February. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, time to have a chat to this week's guests now. With me is Lib Dem councillor for Eastville, Steve Comer. Hi, Steve, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hello, Tony.
Now, after the betrayal of the students, half a million public sector job losses about to happen and the sell-off of the parks in Bristol, will anyone ever vote Lib Dem again?
Is that a question or a statement?
A question.
Yeah, I mean, I would query some of the intro. But yes, absolutely. It's not a park sell-off, it's an investment in parks.
Well, they're selling off parts of parks, and I think people were very attached to their parks, aren't they?
Well, I don't think there are many parks selling off. There are bits of green space which are going.
I'm not talking about the whole park. I'm talking about little corners.
No, that's right. And I think it is important that you make that point, because most of the land disposals are partial disposals. Now, that is in order to do major investment over a 20-year period. And I think there's been a lot of misrepresentation about what this policy is about. And it is a policy that actually isn't a Lib Dem policy. It had all party support until such time as the implementation started. And that's part of the problem with Bristol. We're great at plans and not very good at implementing something. And maybe that's what we can change.
Is it not possible that you could just say, well, OK, we'll sell off the little bits of scrubland and things like that, but we'll leave the parks alone?
Well, that's exactly what is happening. Most of the land that's being sold is small patches of land, open space here and there, informal open space rather than actual parks. The need is to invest in our parks. As you said in your introduction, I represent Eastville. Eastville has a park in the middle of it which has declined over 30 or 40 years, and we need to get that back, because we need quality open spaces, not just open spaces that are barren.
But informal open space is actually sometimes, I mean, say for example a field with footpath through it, that's just as much use to people as its amenity and leisure value as a park is. In fact, in some ways more. Maybe the kids can have a chat to the horses, other animals, whatever in the fields, and you know, that's got in some ways a better value than an ordinary park, hasn't it?
Well, we need both. The problem we've got within Bristol is that there are parts of the city where there's that sort of space in abundance, and there's other parts of the city where that's not there at all. We have to redress that balance. We have to have a move where everyone has some quality open space within, say, 5-10 minutes walk of their home, and that's what the aim of the policy is over a 20-year period. As I say, it's not going to happen overnight, but the decline's probably taken 40 years, so hopefully we can redress it in half that time.
Okay, what about the other issues I brought up there, the projected half a million public sector job cuts? I mean, nobody's going to be slapping the Liberal Democrats on the back and thanking you for that, are they?
Well, no, I'm a public sector worker myself, so I mean, I do understand that, but I mean, where we are as a nation is, you know, the debt crisis was a major issue that had to be dealt with, and I think most of the job losses we're talking about, there would have been cuts whoever won the general election. I think that was quite obvious that was going to happen. There was that pressure building up, and I've had some involvement with colleagues in local government from other countries within the EU, and this isn't a UK phenomenon, this is Europe wide. I mean, Denmark has an austerity package. The Czech Republic has even gone in for pay cuts. You know, Estonia has issues. This is Europe wide, and much of it is worldwide. So I think that whoever won the general election, we'd be in this sort of position. And so I don't actually think you can blame the coalition for that. I think much of it would have happened anyway.
Well, Martin would probably be blaming the coalition for it. Martin, you know, we've seen also in the last couple of weeks the first indication that there may be quite a serious downturn beginning rather than flat growth. Is it a 0.5% cut in growth or roughly about that anyway, and that's been put down to the snow. What are your thoughts on that, old Labour Oxford?
Well, economist? I think it's fair to say that there would have been cuts whoever won the election. In my view, cuts is the wrong policy, whoever carries it out. There's across the whole of Europe, we're now having austerity put forced on us by the financial markets that were bailed out by the taxpayer 2 years ago. And eventually this is going to crash the world economy. And it's probably going to happen sometime this year. And once the economy's crashed and the deficit's got bigger, because that's what will happen, and we'll lose our credit rating. Where Ireland is today, that's Britain in 6 months' time. Eventually there's going to be a revolution in thinking about economics. We're going to, you know, once in a generation, people wake up and realise that the capitalist system is broke and it needs to be fixed. And unfortunately, New Labour certainly didn't have the intellectual power to take on this consensus. And that's why they would what they were proposing to do was pretty much the same as the coalition, which leaves them speechless when the coalition does what they were going to do anyway. But of course, it's all wrong, as we're going to find out. I mean, this is a very interesting time. I used to teach A-level economics, and if I was teaching students today, I would say pay attention, because this is a once-in-a-lifetime change in perception about how the economy works.
I mean, do we have to have a really catastrophic crash before any perceptions change, or are we going to know beforehand?
We shouldn't have to have a catastrophic crash. I mean, in actual fact, the knowledge not to push ourselves into a crash has always been there, but the vested interests pushing us towards it are virtually overwhelming, and most people don't understand the issues. Therefore, they basically presume the people in charge know what they're doing. They're going to find out over this year that they don't.
So I think there's also a problem with politicians and expectations. I mean, I think, you know, we were told not so very long ago that boom and bust had been abolished. And that it was okay. And when Vince Cable warned several years ago now about the level of consumer debt in the country, then, you know, he was more or less laughed at by Gordon Brown and others, and said, well, you know, don't spoil the party, it's fun. Now, you know, that wasn't too long ago, and I can certainly remember at home I used to probably get most days of the week a mail shot from someone in the financial services industry offering me cheap credit or consolidated loans and so on. That's all dried up in the last 6 months. And I think, you know, you have to say that the financial institutions were very much pushing this idea of the never-never, the cheap credit and so on. And much of what we've had was artificial, and equally with public spending. Public spending was going up and up. And, you know, eventually, if there isn't the money in the economy to pay for that, then you've got a problem. And I think that's where we are. Whether what will happen will do as Martin said and push things worse, or whether we've got there in the nick of time and actually saved it, well, you know, time will tell. But the point I'm making is that this is not just the UK, this is Europe-wide and to a large extent international.
But does anyone believe that it's really democratic for us to, ordinary people, to be paying for the mistakes of these international banks? Where, never mind whether it was under a Labour government, Conservative government or Lib Deb, anybody. I mean, surely there's a potential here that the current LibCon alliance could be basically dragging us off down the garden path at the behest of the bankers to pay off their debts for them.
Well, I remember when the general election happened, and one of the things that unnerved me at the time was that the bond markets were going to open early after the close of poll. And I thought, well, hang on a minute. Now, whoever you voted for in the general election, we didn't vote for the bond markets. So I think that's a problem. The difficulty you've got is that because the financial sector is international, there's a limit as to what you can do within the context of one country. But I think as far as the UK is concerned, we do have to look at ourselves a bit, you know. I mean, I was at a meeting of a few months ago with the Tax Justice Network, and half the tax havens in the whole world, one half, are actually British dependencies, you know, the Channel Islands, the Cayman Islands, and so on. And I think, you know, as an ordinary citizen, I've always been on PAYE, like the majority of the population. I've always paid tax, you know, due at the right time. And I think, well, there is a certain amount of illogicality in the UK preaching tax morality to other countries when we've got that sort of track record. And I think we've got to clean up our act a bit.
Well, obviously, I agree with that. I mean, I think we do need fiscal consolidation. You can't just run deficits indefinitely. There's no way to spend your way out in that sense. But that means we've got to have a much more robust discussion about the distribution of wealth, income and power in our society. The top 1% in Britain owns something like 50% of the wealth. I mean, Greg Filo from Glasgow University had an article in The Guardian some weeks ago now where he said, well, we could have a one-off wealth tax to cover the deficit. Why not? And of course it's logical, because don't forget that the wealthy classes in this country have done very well out of financial deregulation. They are a lot wealthier than they were before the City of London was deregulated in the 1980s. Now, if there's a big mess, it's like the Bullingdon Club having a big piss up. There's now a bill to pay, and it's got to be paid by those who are doing the drinking, and that's the top 5-10%.
Well, the trouble with a one-off wealth tax is that you're assuming you can enforce it. I mean, the difficulty is the people who own that wealth will probably move it abroad before you get there. And this was part of the problem with our tax system. We, you know, at times negotiations were done, and people came on board. For instance, the betting industry, when the internet took off, moved a lot of their gambling services to Gibraltar and places like that. Now, they were told that, you know, it, as a quid pro quo for the old betting tax going, that people used to pay in bookmakers and so on, that rather than avoid that by going overseas, they would move that to a tax on gross profits. So that's the sort of discussion that you have to have. But I think you probably have to have it at a European level, and getting that consensus could be difficult.
I agree with that, but I think also one fundamental way in which you can raise money, and when I used to be an advisor in Eastern Europe in the 90s, we were talking about how are you going to fund these new systems that you're setting up, because the wealthy there were very good at hiding their money away. And the obvious conclusion was you've got to have property taxes, because property can't run away. And if you think of the role of the property bubble at the heart of the mess in the British economy, property is the key place to actually squeeze the money out. It's throwing funny money at property bubbles is how we've got into the mess, and property is the weak link from the wealthy class's point of view.
I think there's
an element of that. I mean, certainly if you look at Ireland, Spain and so on, then the common link is a property bubble.
Now, the property tax deals with that at the same time as it can't run away.
Steve, we have a general election every 5 years, or maybe maybe earlier in Britain. We shall see. And that's one day where everybody gets to decide who runs the country, at least partly, and there's flaws in the system. But yeah, the markets are open every single day. And my concern is that the politicians, they think about the votes and the people as a sort of little blip every once in a while. But actually, their main concern is placating the markets. And the markets are banging on their door every day, and the message is coming from the city every day saying, you've got to do this, you've got to do this. And actually, the people don't get a look in.
Well, I think there's an element of that, and obviously we have a representative democracy system, and with things like markets, then yes, and I think they've got increasingly international, increasingly volatile. Speed of communications is much quicker than it was 20 or 30 years ago, and I think that does bring the sensitivity around. I mean, some of us can remember the 92 position with the exchange rate mechanism and so on. But I mean, if you look at the position with Ireland, one of the reasons why they had to go back again, initially they didn't want to bail out, and then within a week they did, was that there was the issue of the value of the bonds that the government issues to raise money. A similar situation with Greece, and I think that's the problem now. This is wider than one country, and if you're not careful, then the financial markets just pick on one after the other.
Well, what's going to happen, I think, is the Irish general election coming up at the end of February, it's more than likely that they're going to elect a government which will repudiate their debt. And in actual fact, they've got to repudiate their debt because the austerity policy being forced on them, the bond market has already concluded.
So what you're saying is they're simply not going to pay?
They're not going to pay because they can't pay. Even if they wanted to pay, they can't pay. And the bond market's schizophrenic. It demands that you carry out austerity, and then it freaks out because the austerity means that you're going to run a bigger budget deficit, and so there's no way out. And at that point, countries default, as Iceland has defaulted. Now, when Ireland defaults, there's about £200 billion exposure of the British banks to the Irish debt. That means there will be another crash in the City of London just because of the Irish default. That's before the Spanish, Portuguese, Greece default. And they're all going to default, and it's all going to come back home to the City of London. And George Osborne is going to face the same dilemma as Gordon Brown faced and Alistair Darling faced, which is, are we going to put the British taxpayer behind our crashing banks? And the answer is going to be no, because there's no way on earth that the British taxpayer has got deep enough pockets to bail them out.
Steve.
So there's going to be a crash. And when we've had a crash, we'll start talking seriously about the distribution of wealth and power.
Steve,
in
it seems that you know, the Libcons at the moment are saying, yes, we will put the British taxpayer behind the banking crash.
Well,
we don't know.
We don't know.
We're not there yet.
I think the problem you've... I mean, that was what happened, and initially the difficulty with the Northern Rock situation was that the Labour government at the time were not prepared to go in and take it over early. That then led to a run. They then had to guarantee the deposits, so we ended up with the worst possible situation where you nationalise the debt and privatise the profitable element. And I think that that's a bit of a lesson. But the difficulty with all this is that, you know, the whole of the economic system is based on confidence, and if confidence starts to ebb away rapidly, then you do have a problem, and you do run the risk of a worldwide crash. I would hope that the stakes are so high that doesn't happen, but it does lead you into questions about how you manage an economy and to what extent an economy can even be managed, given where we are now. It's a different world from what it was even 20 years ago.
Now, as JP Morgan Chase, America's second biggest bank, marks a profitable 2010 by paying out $10 billion. Yes, that's $10 billion in bonuses, which is a nominal average of about $400,000 for its 26,000 employees each. Should bank bonuses be taxed? Well, at least angry homeowners in the US were protesting against JP Morgan Chase outside the New York Stock Exchange recently, as it was announced that the chief executive, Jamie Dimon, is to receive something like £17 million worth of bonuses. Now, on Russia Today, Max Kaiser on the Kaiser Report looked at Jamie Dimon because he's been at the World Economic Forum in the Swiss Alps in Davos, which is where they discuss much of where our economy is going. And so let's have a listen to now, and we can have comments from Steve and Martin afterwards.
Hi, I'm Max Kaiser, and this is the Kaiser Report. You know, those scoundrels are in Davos talking about different weapons of mass financial destruction and how to destroy the world economy. Let's bring on Stacey Herbert. Hello, Stacey.
Hi, Max. Yes, you mentioned Davos, and the headline reads, Sarkozy goes postal on Jamie Dimon, says bankers made world into madhouse. So this was at an event in Davos. Jamie Dimon spoke first, and he praised governments for intervening to save the financial system in 2008. But then said, and he referred to Sarkozy, that the G20 group of major economies, which Sarkozy chairs this year, should take a deep breath before imposing regulation. Jamie Dimon said, too much is too much. Not all banks are the same. I just think that this constant refrain, bankers, 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 is just unproductive and unfair. People should just stop doing that.
Yeah, I don't get it. JP Morgan caught inducing fraudulently in the mortgage market. They don't hit minimum capital reserve requirements. They are involved in terrorist scandals. Jamie Dimon sucking the financial integrity out of the U.S. economy. What do you mean enough is enough? I don't get it, Jamie Dimon. You know, you've been caught stealing money from Americans, stealing money from the globe, committing acts of financial terrorism, in bed with the terrorists. What do you mean it's enough is enough? Enough is not enough until you're in freaking jail! Jail! I'm sick of Jamie Dimon. Enough is enough of Jamie Dimon. Somebody shut this guy down.
This is how President Sarkozy of France responded to Jamie Dimon. He said, quote, "Too much is too much. The world was stupefied to see one of the five biggest U.S. banks collapse like a house of cards. I don't contest the principle of securitization, but when one offshore country guaranteed 700 times its GDP, are we in the market economy or in a madhouse?"
Sarkozy is absolutely correct. I want to direct Jamie Dimon's attention to what's happening in Tunisia, Algeria, Egypt, Athens, Dublin, the global insurrection against banker occupation. People are angry and they've got their pitchforks. They've got their torches. They have historically used guillotines when people like Jamie Dimon get into the mix and steal with impunity. That's wrong.
Well, Max, it's not just us who think this, and it's not just Sarkozy who thinks this, and all the people rioting around the world. The now a congressional committee, the Financial Crisis Inquiry Committee, has also found these very same people guilty. So the next headline is, "Financial Crisis Was Avoidable," inquiry finds. Of course, we all know
Of course it was avoidable. If you give a gun, a loaded gun, to a maniac and you point it, he kills people with it. If you didn't give him the loaded gun with the bullets in it, he wouldn't have killed people. It's avoidable. If you give the bankers all this free money at 0% interest rate, and whenever they make a mistake, you bail them out, it's a recipe for disaster. Of course they're going to commit acts of financial terrorism. Right there at the Fed, right there at the Treasury, right there in the White House. They gave them 0% interest on all the money they want to commit all the acts of terrorism they want. And whenever they make a mistake, they get bailed out. Of course it's avoidable. Of course it's avoidable. How come they're not in jail? How come they're not? How come there's not drones going over Davos right now and taking these guys out? They're freaking terrorists.
Well, that's the high temperature expletives of Max Kaiser there on Russia Today on the Kaiser Report. Steve, do you want to just react to some of what you're saying there? Do you think we should stop banker bashing?
No, I think that it's understandable that the anger is in that direction. I think the difficulty with the banking sector is it's become intertwined. I think there used to be a strict segregation between banking that was consumer related and, you know, relatively low risk business, consumer lending and so on, and the investment banking, which is high risk, big money. And I think the difficulty is if you put them together, which is what we've actually done, you then end up with institutions that are too big to fail, because if they fail, their reverberations are throughout the economy. So I think I think it does need there does need to be regulation, but, you know, it does need to, you know, I keep repeating this, it does need to be done on a supranational level, because otherwise all that happens is that capital flows to the area where the regulation is least, and they operate through subsidiaries. So I think I can understand the banker bashing. It's limited as far as it goes, but understandable, because you always attack whoever got you into the mess.
Yeah, I mean, I think Max Kaiser's approach, you know, the way he approaches things there sounds slightly comical, but he is a Wall Street insider. I mean, he's a very, very highly thought of financial analyst. And when people like that are saying that what's been going on here is fraud, I think we ought to be listening. During the savings and loans scandal in the 1980s, which was part of the Reagan deregulation era, thousands of top executives were sent to prison, and it was uncovered that the CIA were moving drugs through the savings and loans, drugs money through the savings and loans organisations and so on. A lot of this would be dealt with not by raising tax rates, but by enforcing the existing laws against fraud. Yeah. And that means that once you put somebody in prison, you don't say they're going to go away to a foreign country and invest somewhere else, and if you raise their tax rate, you confiscate all their assets. All of them.
This sounds like it's very likely to happen in Iceland. We've seen some of the senior bankers in Iceland being arrested. Steve, do you think Nick Clegg and David Cameron and George Osborne have got the guts to do that here in Britain?
Well, I think if it's shown that what was done was fraudulent, then I think that is the case. The difficulty is always in improving what is fraudulent and what is just a speculative investment that went wrong. I think certainly there is a mood to tackle the problem, but I think there is a difficulty with the balance of the UK economy, and that a lot has been vested in the City of London over many years, and it has been a profitable sector for the UK economy, but I think we've become over-reliant on it.
Martin, what about you? Because, you know, you've said it's easy with the benefit of hindsight to agree with Max there and say, well, actually, this was all avoidable.
Well, it was avoidable. I mean, as Steve pointed out, I mean, the repeal of the I can't remember the name, the Graham... There was an act which separated
Glass-Steagall.
Which separated retail banking from investment banking in the 1930s for exactly this reason. That's why Roosevelt forced it through. Yeah. Now, when Obama took over in the US, he should have been giving, you know, it's the US to put to the lead and everybody else to follow if we're going to have global regulation. Obama should have stormed into the city, into Wall Street, as Roosevelt did. Roosevelt set up the PCORA Commission. They investigated what had gone on. They completely changed the rules and regulations. Loads of people lost their jobs. It was a one hit, bang, crash, wallop. I'm the president. This is what's going to happen. Everybody thought that Obama might do those things. But, of course, the problem is that the political system has become corrupted. The bankers are the main funders of the political parties, and that's true of the Labour Party, even let alone other parties. And this creates a vicious circle whereby the banks can't be criticised because they pay for the politics. And what the electorate wants or doesn't want is very much second fiddle.
That's a bit worrying, Steve, isn't it? Because there's a tug of war going on here. You've got the people and their democratic representatives, people like you and Nick Clegg, on the one side, and then on the other side you've got the bankers and the city and Wall Street. Who's going to win that tug of war?
Well, up until now, I think the financiers have been winning more often than not. But I think if democracy means anything, then it has to be that those who are voted in have that ability to pull that back.
I mean, one of the real class, absolutely obvious things here is that we do own large parts of our national banks here in Britain now, and yet it seems that we're not actually prepared to use that shareholding to influence what goes on the board.
And I think we should have done, and the bonus crisis particularly, you know, staggered me, because if we think the level of bonuses are immoral and you're the majority shareholding, then you control who's on the board of directors.
The only crisis.
I think that could be done, and we have the ability and the power to do it.
Well, the only crisis there is that nothing was done by Clegg and Cameron.
Well, nothing's been done yet. I mean, there is a review of the banks and regulation coming out, so we'll see over the medium to long term whether that's happened. But I hope that there is some clawing back of this, because I think if not, then the level of popular discontent will continue to rise, and I can understand why.
Now, Marina Morris is joining us. What have you got for us this week, Marina?
Hello. This week, the government published a new mental health strategy for England, which promised an extra £400 million for therapies such as counselling, and to increase access to these treatments by 60% by 2015. At the same time, some staff working in Mental Health Care Trust have been warned of imminent spending cuts and job losses. In Britain, at any time, around one adult in six is experiencing symptoms of mental illness, and one in four will experience mental illness during their lifetime. Mental illness is the largest single cause of disability in our society and cost the English economy at least £77 billion a year. Compare this with £400 million of the new funding. A million British children, one in 10 between the age of 5 to 16, are estimated to be mentally ill. Newspapers are calling our children the disturbed generation. According to Mind's pamphlet, How to Improve Our Health Well-being, good mental health isn't something you have, but something you do. Treatment can take many forms. A healthy lifestyle can help people maintain good mental health. Change to diet, exercise level, alcohol consumption can help protect people or aid recovery. Talking therapists, which include counseling, cognitive behavioral therapy and psychoanalysis, medication, participating in the arts, and other treatments include electroconvulsive therapy and brain surgery. These alarming mental health statistics are warning that we are still vulnerable and unprotected against many and increased everyday pressure, competitiveness, cuts and job losses. It's like a tug of war. Who will win? Our emotion can drive and destroy us, imprison us in negativity, or we can take control of them and bring quality to our day-to-day life. It is not only one in four of us who will experience the mental problems now and in the future. It's all of us living in disturbed society who can't escape from the atmosphere and tendency of the community. Whilst for most of us the answer is self-help, mixed funding message from government appears to be endangering the continuity of existing service provision. Good mental health isn't something you have, but something you do.
Thanks, Marina. Now, Steve, I wonder if you could just react to that, Lib Dem Councillor for Eastville. We're told, really by Marina there, partly, that anyway, that there is a bit of a crisis going on. There seems to be more money going into mental health services, and yet they're also threatened with these public sector cuts. We've also got big changes in the National Health Service. It seems like everything's happening at once. And the big problem, of course, is that many, many things that the police are having to deal with now is simply people with mental health problems who are out on the street rather than being cared for.
Yes, I think there are a lot of things happening at once, and one of the things I'd like to see coming out of it as a positive, if we can, is more joining up of services between various providers that are involved in them, because often you'll find that if you've got a particular couple or a family, that you know you might have the mental health service involved, the GP, you might have the council social services, you might have a voluntary organisation, and so on. And I hope that what we can get to is a better organised and less bureaucratic health service. The financial pressures are there; they always are with health, and that there's always more demand than you can ever possibly supply. What I am pleased about is there is a commitment towards retaining a public health service, and we're not going down the road of say the American option, which some people on the fringes of politics like Daniel Hannan MEP want us to do, but there's got to be a better way of organising it. I think that there is too much duplication, too many tiers of management involved, and if we can find a way of actually making it more person-centred, then I think that will be a positive. But it's not easy, and a lot's got to be done in a relatively short space of time.
Yes, but I mean, this present government didn't have any mandate to reform the National Health Service. In fact, it guaranteed it was going to do nothing to change the way the NHS was organised. And we've got some quite. Well, we had a listen last week to Spinwatch, which is a little department up at Glasgow University. They were essentially saying that this whole initiative of part privatisation of the National Health Service is really been put together by some very powerful pharmaceutical companies and mostly US health insurance companies.
Well, pharmaceutical companies are always a handy Aunt Sally, but there were proposals for change in there. The Liberal Democrat manifesto envisaged removing the strategic health authorities, for instance. I think the Conservative manifesto had some indications on this. Obviously, what's happening, and we shall see what form it takes. I mean, in Bristol, I know the GP consortia, for instance, are coming together now. We will have to see how that turns out, but there is always a risk that if you've got well-organised lobby groups that they could come in. But I think that was a risk anyway under the previous government's policy. And so I don't think that much has changed. What I hope is that we get a service that's closer to people and more relevant to patient need. But, you know, I accept the fact that it's rapid change and with an uncertain outcome. But if you don't make a change, you know, the NHS as we had it was, I think, the largest employer in the world apart from the Indian Railway and the Chinese Army, and I'm not sure that was the best way of organising things.
Well, I think that you better be right about this, because if you get it wrong, both the Liberal Democrats and the Conservative Party are going to be destroyed at the next election, whenever it is, and I think it's going to be before 2014. You didn't really have a mandate for any of this. I mean, David Cameron said explicitly there will be no top-down reorganisation of the health service. Now, of course, he's finessing that by saying this isn't a top-down reorganisation. This is the big society spontaneously coming up with a cultural revolution from below. And I think it could be compared to the cultural revolution. I mean, Vince Cable himself has talked about the Maoist spirit at work in the cabinet. Let's bombard headquarters and just see what happens. Now, coming back to what we were talking about earlier about the possibility of a crash and the possibility that the government may have to bail out the banks again or not bail them out, all of this is rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic. In actual fact, all of these pet projects for building free schools and reforming the health service to make it more responsive to patients, always, actually the level of satisfaction with the health service was the highest it's ever been just before the election. And I don't care if they do employ more people than the Chinese army. Health is far more important to people than lap dancing clubs, which are supposedly wealth creation.
The question is, these employ people to do what? I think that's the problem with the way health has been organised. I mean, the current system with the PCTs has been likened to a situation where GPs put orders in a basket, and then the PCT is there at the checkout with the debit card. Now, I think the idea is that if that's what their role is, you might as well give the GPs the debit card. Now,
but then they'll have to employ somebody to be the PCT for them,
yes,
because they're doctors, not business people.
Of course
they
will. Of course they will. In other words,
all you're doing is reinventing the wheel in another format. I mean, actually, I want to make the case as well for central planning. All of this stuff about decentralisation is a good thing. No, it's not. Decentralisation means postcode lotteries. It means that in certain parts of the country you won't get cancer treatments that you will be able to get elsewhere. And once that happens, people are going to go mad. They are. They actually like the National Health Service. It's the most efficient way of organising healthcare in the world. Per pound for pound, you get more bang for your buck with a nationalised, centralised system. Let's make the case. Central planning. What's the problem with that? It's worked in this country for 50 years. Why scrap it?
Well, I'm not sure it has always worked for 50 years, and I think that there have been a lot of concerns about the way services have been delivered. We had the issue with waiting lists. We've had the target culture under the last government where, you know, there were targets for this and that. So all that happens is you manipulate the service to meet the targets. And you know,
that's wrong. That was wrong.
But that's right.
And the door has been open to all of this. But what I'm trying to do on this programme, Steve, is to change the intellectual framework within which we debate these things. New Labour have opened the door to all of the kind of things that we're talking about here. They were responsible for starting to fragment the service. Because they didn't believe in their own ideology of central planning. I'm reminding them that that is actually... The OECD did a study a couple of years ago, and we don't have the best health service in the world, but by God, we've got the cheapest. Because they spend a hell of a lot more of GDP on healthcare in France and Germany, and they've got better quality. They've got virtually the same outcomes as us, and we're spending... the US spends 15% of its GDP.
But in many of the Scandinavian countries, for instance, they have a more responsive service because local authorities still run hospitals.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks, folks. We had a good run out on the NHS there, and we did deal with it last week as well. But I will refer listeners to, if they're interested in the lobbying behind these changes to the National Health Service, to have a look at the website from Glasgow Strathclyde University's spinwatch.org. And if you go to that particular website, you'll see a 15-minute frightening film about the think tanks and the lobbying industry behind some of these proposed changes. Anyway, debt advice services we hear this week are heading for the public sector scrap heap. Now, more than ever, specialist advice centres such as certain ones, particularly places like Bristol Debt Advice Centre, are needed to help those who are trying not to drown in debt. This is from The Guardian on Wednesday. Apparently, by the end of March this year, 10 debt advised colleagues from the Mary Ward Legal Centre will be without a job. As a direct result, 15,000 fewer Londoners, this is a debt advice centre in London, with debt problems will go without help this year. Many of the cases that are currently being worked on will also have to be closed. Martin, I mean, you were involved in Bristol Debt Advice Centre, weren't you? This seems like there's the rug being pulled out from many of these debt advice centres around the country now.
Yeah, I mean, this was predictably going to be the case. I mean, debt advice for people who are vulnerable is a key frontline service. It's not an extra add-on. And then some government spokespeople this week have been saying, yes, but we want to help people not get into debt in the first place. And that's going to be our strategy for dealing with this, rather than helping them once they're in debt. And that seems rather fatuous when we've got a situation, as we found out last week, that over 1 million or 2 million people are paying their mortgages with their credit cards. We're in a hell of a mess. The idea that you're going to stop people getting into debt is fatuous. They're already in debt. And debt advice and consolidation is a key way of helping people. And cutting back debt advice at this moment is short-sighted, foolish and crazy, frankly.
I would agree with that. And I'm very pleased that in the draft budget that will go to council in February, then certainly Bristol City Council has looked at this, because we provide some grant aid to debt advice and we've protected that, and we realise that there is increasing need. Whether it can be organised better, I think, is perhaps something you can discuss. Sometimes there's multi-agencies involved, but we have protected the funding, and I think it's right that you do. But I think Martin's right up to a point. I think financial education is a weakness and is a problem. I'm in my 50s now. Never at any time in the education system was I given any real idea about how a mortgage works, how a loan works, and how interest works, and so on. The difference between simple and compound interest.
Oh, crikey! You're in charge of our city.
Well, no, I'm no different to anyone else. That's it wasn't done. Now, having said that is part of the one side of the coin, but the other side of the coin is helping people when they get into debt, because people often take on commitments that they can manage for a time, and then if one partner is sick or loses a job, then it doesn't happen, and that's when debt advice comes in. So I think it does need to be protected, but what I would like to see is in the review of the banks and financial services that rather than that having to be funded by the taxpayer, that we actually fund it by a levy on the financial institutions. I think that would be the way forward in the future.
I agree that it should be that the financial institutions should pay, but then going round the houses again, we own the financial institutions.
Yeah.
So we should make them,
they're
basically nationalised, so we should just instruct them to pay for it.
So Martin, have you got a little bit of belated debt advice for George Osborne, the Chancellor at the moment? Because he's having to struggle with quite a massive debt, isn't he? Never mind family.
Not personally. No,
that's
personally.
Right.
He's
all at arm's length for people like George, isn't it?
Mm.
Okay, and keeping with George, the Chancellor could miss the deficit deadline. This is on Wednesday on Sky News. The Chancellor's strategy to eliminate the national deficit by the next election is facing criticism from the Institute for Fiscal Studies, and the annual green budget compiled by the IFS and Barclays analysts 7 weeks before George Osborne's budget speech, which is coming up soon, raises concerns about an apparent lack of flexibility in the government's approach. Martin, what's going to happen if George does miss the deficit deadline? As it looks like he may be doing.
I think this is the nub of the matter, isn't it? I mean, I would see the deficit that the government has as a symptom of the economic crisis rather than the economic crisis itself. But if going forward we have a situation where the coalition government actually increases the deficit, and that's what's happened in Greece, Ireland and Iceland before they repudiated their debts. If we got a situation going into the summer where the deficit's actually increasing as the economy goes down the drain, I think the intellectual basis for the policy being pursued will be blown out of the water. And I look to the Shadow Chancellor, Ed Balls, to kick 10 tonnes of whatever out of the Chancellor.
Well, I mean, Ed Balls, deficit in Naira, one of the advisers that probably got us into a lot of this mess in the first place. So I don't think he's in a position to lecture the rest of the world. This is a problem, and this is a jam. But I was talking to a colleague from the Local Councils Association from Greece a few weeks ago, and you've now got a position where Greece is effectively run by what he affectionately calls a troika of the IMF, the European Central Bank, and third, and it is that way around, the Greek government. And I think that's the difficulty.
Repudiate their debts and crash the City of London. That's the logical thing. The Greeks should follow their national interest, repudiate the debts they owe to our British banks, and then put the problem in George Osborne's lap. And you know what? That's what the people on the streets of Greece will be demanding.
Well,
that's what's going to happen.
The problem you then get is you then have a Europe-wide recession very quickly. And
I think
that's too much of a risk to take.
Well, it's going to happen anyway, whether you think it's a risk or not. And if the people running the country don't realise that we're in a ship that's about to hit an iceberg, then there's a serious problem. I think that the coalition, all of it, are woefully unprepared for where they've ended up. And the new Labour people would have been equally unprepared. We've got to change the attitude about what economics is all about. We've had a whole generation of free market nonsense, and it's now been proved completely to be nonsense. Milton Friedman was just wrong about the way the economy works. Wrong.
I'm reminded, Martin, by listening to what you said, I saw a banner, I think it was at the G20 or G8 demonstration a couple of years ago, and this is one of the problems that gets to the nub of it. And the banner said, replace capitalism with something nicer. And I'm sure we'd agree with that. What we wouldn't agree on is what the something nicer is. We've seen the command and control central economy, and that doesn't work.
No, it doesn't work, apart from in China, where it does, of course. except that they've got similar problems because they've had too much capitalism. Capitalism is in fact a dead donkey. The banks are bust if they're carrying out Enron accounting to account themselves as in profit so they can pay out shareholders and bonuses. But if you actually look at the books properly, they're bust.
But Martin, it's certainly not a dead donkey in China, is it?
No, it is a dead donkey. This is what makes me laugh about central planning doesn't work except when it does. I mean, the Chinese have got 10% growth a year, etc., etc. But of course, in a country like that, you've got to have 10% growth a year just to stand still because you've got a huge population problem. But of course, they have also got a property bubble in Shanghai. Their export markets are going to crash because of the recession in Europe, and they're going to have a similar problem. They're going to have mass unrest in China. We've saw what happens on the streets of Egypt this week. The Chinese have tried to block their people from seeing what's happening in Egypt because they know very well that they could face exactly the same challenge.
Well, we did have mass unrest in China with Tiananmen Square. We know what happened with that. So I think
the working class weren't mobilised at that stage because they were actually making money. The economy was growing.
Yeah.
I mean, if you've got inflation
you buy people off with increased wealth for a short time.
Yeah. All of our political parties are going to have to adapt to the crisis, and it's not gone away. It's going to get more intense.
Now, Max,
we need a serious discussion about economics.
Max Kaiser earlier on was linking some of the crisis to the scenes we've been witnessing the last week or so in Cairo. We've heard a couple of stories over the last day or so. The Israeli Prime Minister says no to Cairo elections. That was in the Jerusalem Post. And Thierry Maison at the Voltaire Network says Egypt could be on the brink of a bloodbath. Maison says the mainstream media are enthralled by the demonstrations in Egypt, heralding the event of a Western-style democracy throughout the Middle East. But Thierry Maison refutes this interpretation. According to him, antagonistic forces have been set in motion, the outcome of which will turn against the order imposed by the US in the region. So, Martin, do you want to just give your take on what we've been seeing in Egypt over the last week, and particularly see if you can predict which way it's going to go and if Mubarak will step down?
Well, obviously predictions are very difficult in a situation like this. I was worried this afternoon that there was going to be a bloodbath. It seems to have gone very peacefully this afternoon. That's good. One hopes that something positive, people will get to a democratic election this year in Egypt with all major political forces participating. But I think it's absolutely outrageous for the Israeli Prime Minister to speak up and demand that they don't hold free elections in Cairo.
They're worried, of course, that Islamic extremists may win.
Well, Hezbollah, a coalition, have just taken over in Lebanon. That's another headache for the Israelis. But I'm afraid the danger with democracy, as we found in France in the 1780s, is democracy sometimes leads to revolutionary war, and that's definitely possibly on the cards here. People should have no delusions. The banks are broke. This is a worse crisis than 1936 or 1939, and we've got there's a real danger here of everything going to pieces very, very quickly. I hope they do get democracy in Egypt, but of course the obstacles in the way are enormous, including the huge army financed by our taxes.
Well, Martin's slip was quite interesting actually, because I remember when there wasn't democracy in Greece, and it wasn't that long ago.
No, it's not that long ago.
And I remember when the colonels took over. I also remember, because it was about a year later, I was first year of secondary school, the Prague Spring and what was happening there and the attempt to reform that very centralised Stalinist system and how that was crushed.
Now, do you think there are lessons from those then? We may be able to predict in some way what's going to happen in Egypt?
I don't think you can predict. The interesting one will be the role of the army in Egypt, because they're not like a conventional army. They run businesses and factories and so on. Now, they will want to maintain that position. I think if they see that is drifting away from Mubarak, then their backing will cease. I think it's rather rich of the Israelis who for years have said that they're the only democracy in the region to actually criticise the potential of democracy elsewhere on the basis that they can't predict the winners. And this is this is crazy. But for years we've had a position where governments, Western governments, have backed strong leaders in the region, and we've been speaking with forked tongue. I mean, the whole business with Iraq was that we were bringing democracy to Iraq, and what were we propping up? Saudi Arabia, which is a feudal monarchy.
So should Mubarak go? This is what he's saying. Mubarak says, I resign, but Egypt would descend into chaos.
Well, I think it may do, and but I think Mubarak should go, because clearly he doesn't have the credibility of anyone, really. And the question is, what does replace it? Now, hopefully, if things go well, you can have a constituent assembly, amend the constitution and move to a democratic state. Whether that happens or not, or whether there's a multi-stage process in between, I don't know.
Well, the obvious thing to do is to form a transitional government with all major political forces involved to prepare for an election this year. I mean, that's what you'd say in the Greek case or in the Czech case.
That's exactly what happened.
And, you know, the model should be exactly the same. And we shouldn't be frightened of the Islamist parties. They are absolutely legitimate. I mean, the West has got to get over this idea that Islamism is. I mean, they're aligned with Hamas, who won the election in Palestine. Of course, they're going to be very friendly to Hamas if they win the election in Cairo. The Israelis won't like that, but that's democracy.
And it depends what you mean by Islamist, doesn't it? I mean, the AK Party in Turkey, for instance, are called Islamist, but I mean, they're Islamist in as much as mainstream Christian Democrat parties in Europe are Christian. I mean,
exactly.
They're a centre-right party.
We've got to normalise this.
Absolutely.
Instead of being frightened of it. Why can't people vote for Islamist parties as long as they abide by the rules? And of course, they can't enforce things like dress codes and stuff on people. That's got to be in the constitution. But if they feel that they've got the capacity to govern the country and the support of the people, then they should be allowed to have a go.
But the places who do enforce things like dress codes and so on are places like Saudi Arabia with authoritarian governments.
Exactly.
Now, on to a local story here. Stephen Williams, your friendly MP, Liberal Democrat MP, is voting with the government on the forest sell-off. And this is turning to a web blog called turningbristolred.wordpress.com. Why can't he just give us a simple, honest answer? Yesterday, and this was from yesterday's web blog, Stephen Williams voted with the government in an opposition day debate on selling off our forests. In Bristol, our local Lib Dems are supporting parks and green space sell-offs. Nationally, they're supporting forest sell-offs. I don't think they can pretend to be environmentalists anymore. Do you? Do you, Steve?
Well, I think Turning Bristol Red gives you the idea that perhaps this website is not full of people who will have voted for Stephen Williams in the last two general elections when he's been returned to Parliament.
But would you have voted for the forest sell-off?
I must admit, I haven't looked in detail at the forest issue, because it's not something that that affects me directly in Bristol.
It seems to be stirring up the nation as a whole, though.
Yeah, and I'm not sure the detail of this and whether this will actually go through. As I heard it was a sort of consultation process, and sometimes that happens, isn't it? You raise a spectre and see what happens. I do think there's an issue with the Forestry Commission being both regulator of forests and owner of forests. Maybe it would be cleaner if that was set into two parts, one that was the regulator and one that is the owner. But as I say, it's not forests are not something we have a lot of in Eastville, so I haven't looked in great detail at this one the last few days.
I think what strikes me about this forest sell-off and many of the other initiatives from the government is that there's a huge, the policy seems to be to try and do as much as possible as fast as possible, a kind of shock therapy approach to what's going on. And I question whether that's wise from the point of view of the coalition. I mean, people voted, I think, for the Conservative Party, certainly, because they wanted basically a Conservative policy. And I think that the coalition MPs are wildly misjudging the public mood if they think that they want to see masses of radical change in things. I don't think people do want to see that, and they're rather dismayed to have. And then, of course, this is all getting knocked back now because people are criticising it, and the government's basically U-turning on a lot of it. Why bring things forward which provoke such hostility when you could just leave well alone?
I think you're right. There is an element of shock and awe about this, but I think also there's some lessons learned, and I think one of the things that has been learned is that the last government, when it came in 97, was very cautious for about two or three years and didn't seem to want to do anything and move on its agenda. It didn't move on the constitution, didn't move on the euro, seemed frightened of offending the Daily Mail. And I think part of this is to get a lot of wheels and plates spinning on the basis that some of them will stop spinning or crash, and then you've got some change. And I think it's a reaction to what happened before, and the the strong caution of the early Blair years.
Well, I understand why that's happened, but at the same time, we're in a different situation. I mean, the economy was growing then. We've got a crisis now.
Okay, guys. Last story we're going to look at this week is in the Daily Mail, we're told, since you were talking about that, get ready for super lorries weighing 60 tonnes under new European Union plans. Now, I can remember about 8-10 years ago when the lorries went up to 44 tonnes, which everyone thought was massive. Now it seems they're going up to 60 tonnes. Do you want to start on this one, Steve? This sounds crazy.
Yeah, firstly, I don't believe anything the Daily Mail says about the European Union, but one thing I do know, I've had some involvement in it, as I said, through my work with the local government association, and any change like this doesn't come out of the blue. There will have been there's a highly deliberative lawmaking policy in the EU, and if we've not missed a trick on this one, then that is a disaster. But I wouldn't like to see this on some of our A roads and narrow roads.
Yeah, I mean, I think already we're paying well over the whack. At least, basically, private drivers are subsidising these massive lorries, aren't they, Martin?
That's right. The real problem is that the tax on lorries is not sufficient to offset the damage they do to the roads. Mm. I mean, basically, if you change that, then you'd sort a lot of this out.
Okay, well, thanks very much, folks. We're coming up now to the time for the Sky News at 6. Thanks to this week's guest, who's Lib Dem councillor for Eastville, Steve Comer. After the news, a new initiative in the city to help skilled people, including the jobless who have no prospect of a mortgage, to build or part build their own homes. The Bristol Community Land Trust has just signed up its first 150 members. And we have, as a guest, we have architect George Ferguson in too. And after that, we have Louis Theroux's TV documentary with Israeli settlers last night. We talk about Jewish groups, which are supporting equality between Jews and Arabs. After the news.
3.2 FM. It is your voice and it is your choice.
The CFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol...